Support for Central Florida Public Media comes from the Central Florida Community Arts Symphony Orchestra, presenting Celebrate the Season, December 4th and 5th at Northland in Longwood. The country's largest orchestra shares traditional melodies, orchestral showstoppers, and more. Ticket information at cfcarts.com/NPR.
Devastating rains passed through Central Florida earlier this week. Lake and Brevard counties received over 12 inches of rain in less than 12 hours, with some parts of Lake County receiving nearly 20 inches of rain. Houses were breached and roads were swept away by the flash flooding. We speak to those who were on the ground about the damage caused by the water. You're listening to Engage on Central Florida Public Media. I'm Joe Mario Pedersen, sitting in for Sharon Stone. Also, Hurricane Melissa was a Category 5 hurricane with incredible strength. We connect with Central Floridians with ties to the Caribbean who are worried for their loved ones caught in the storm's path. And we tap into the local coffee party scene of Orlando. Daytime parties in restaurants and coffee shops are a rising trend among young and older adults. We ask why the daytime party scene appeals to them. But first, late on Sunday night and into early Monday morning, an extraordinary rain event pushed through Brevard and Lake counties, causing floodwaters to quickly rise in both counties. The downpours have left both areas with water that has yet to fully recede. The National Weather Service reported Eustis had 19.7 inches of rain in one location over a 24-hour period. Mount Dora recorded 17.86 inches of rain in Brevard County. Port St. John, Titusville, and Port Canaveral all recorded more than 14 inches of rain. Both the city of Titusville and Lake County have declared a state of emergency. Titusville Mayor Andrew Connor spoke with Central Florida Public Media about the suddenness of the deluge.
So we received radar and weather reports that we were anticipated 3 to 5 inches of rain on Sunday. Nothing out of the ordinary, really, in Florida this time of year. But we really didn't anticipate the weather hanging on like it did. It seems like the meteorologist on Monday, like the Monday morning quarterback, and go, okay, we can tell you now why this happened, but we didn't really have those anticipations ahead of time to make preparations normally like we would in a hurricane situation where we have plenty of time to get residents sandbags and have disaster response crews ready. We were kind of really caught very much off guard.
Were there any particular communities within Titusville that were especially vulnerable that saw more damage than other areas?
Yeah, we have neighborhoods that are in a flood-prone area that, you know, flood in a normal hurricane, and so they definitely were more affected this time around, and we're still working on addressing those areas. Unfortunately, with the wetlands being as saturated as there are, there's not a whole lot of places where that water can go, but our crews are working on getting it moving downstream so it can keep flowing. We received reports last night that the St. John's has finally crested a little bit, so you know there's more room for that water to flow off too.
You had declared a state of emergency. I was wondering if there's any way that you could explain to us how does that help those that are affected? I know in some other cases when a mayor declares a state of emergency, that can qualify you guys for federal aid. Does the same thing work here, or how does that go?
Yeah, so on October 27th at 10 a.m., I declared a state of emergency in the city of Titusville. And the goal of that was to streamline processes and make sure that our residents knew that we're going to do everything we possibly could to help those that are affected. Unfortunately, the county had not declared the same state of emergency in North Brevard County, and therefore that has kind of prevented us from swimming upstream. I'm currently in talks with our state government officials to try to see if we can get the state to ask on our behalf for FEMA support as we try to recover and rebuild and get some assistance for our residents.
I know that the state is sending pumpers into Mount Dora to remove some of the water. Are you looking for those kinds of resources, or is it more of a relief type of resource that you're looking for?
Yeah, so over the last few days, we've been accessing pumper trucks and septic sewer trucks, all the equipment we needed from other municipalities around the county. A lot of municipalities weren't affected in the southern part of the county. It was mostly just north of 528, right? So we kind of saw it up here. So we accessed the resources within the county, and even an FDOT sent a pumper truck to us as well. I think it was mostly because 95 was a little bit... overwhelmed, but we got some of those resources and we're using them currently.
You talk about being in conversations with state government to see if we can get any help from FEMA. Is my question maybe completely not one thing having to do with another, but would the government shutdown have any effect in how long things help to get to you guys?
I do not have the answer to that question. You know, unfortunately, I'm not an expert in federal government. That's a whole different ball game. But I can tell you, I have had a personal phone call with Senator Rick Scott, Representative Herodopoulos. They know our concerns. They're working on their end to help our residents here in Titusville.
Would we happen to know possibly why Brevard has decided to not declare a state of emergency?
Apparently, they didn't feel the damage rose to that level. But I can't speak for them.
Seeing as that there were some roads that were considered, the damage was considered severe, how long could recovery efforts take? Do we know that, or is it too early to tell?
It's kind of too early to tell at this point. We're still trying to make sure the water gets to where it goes, and we make sure those residents can get in and out of their homes, assess, and start that recovery process. It's really important that all of our residents go on the Brevard County Emergency Management page and report their damage, because the more reporting we have, the more numbers we can back up to say, hey, this was a real catastrophe, you know, we need some help.
At last night's city meeting, I know residents spoke about the elimination of trees, ponds being to their maximum level, and how that is affecting the flooding. Is there anything that maybe you are doing moving forward to prevent something like what happened this week happening again?
Yeah. Well, first of all, I don't think we're going to get 15 inches of rain on a regular occurrence. I mean, that was kind of out of the ordinary, once in a 500-year storm, from what I'm being told by the engineers. But that being said, we're going to make sure we're doing everything we can to prevent this going forward. The first thing I asked council to do was to rework the stormwater master plan in its entirety to make sure we have the latest and greatest technology, science, techniques, so that when we're planning, we can update these things as things come available. I also think it's important that we take advantage of every available resource to us, and properties that are more prone to flood, that flood all the time, we as a city should look at maybe procuring some of those things to turn into stormwater ponds and make sure that we're keeping the rest of the neighborhood safe.
Are there any residents that are currently displaced from their home?
Yes.
What resources are being provided for them insofar as shelter and material?
So the Red Cross is set up at First United Methodist Church downtown. They're providing shelters, food, and things for people to you know, kind of regroup and recover. So they ask that people bring their personal effects, medications, things like that. But there are blankets there and food. And then the Salvation Army was giving out supplies at our Harry T. Moore Social Services Center throughout the day yesterday. And I believe they're going to be out there again as well.
I was actually out with them this morning, and I spoke to them, and they were telling me that it was about, out of the damages that they were assessing, about 6 to 10 homes were considered severely damaged. However, that it could take more time to know to what extent they need to go out there and help those residents. Have you been able to speak to them with that? Do you know anything about that?
You're talking about the Salvation Army or Red Cross?
Red Cross, sorry.
I literally just got off the phone with the executive director of the Red Cross, Ms. Janet. And so we're in constant communication about what's going on, and they're helping us collect damage assessments as well. And that's the beauty of our community, is it's not just, you know, the public sector, it's the private sector, the nonprofits, everybody kind of working together to figure out what was lost and how do we move forward.
Red Cross was saying that they might be out there maybe 24 more hours. What are we going to do maybe for those people that still are not able to go home after those 24-hour period? What's the help for them? What's next for them?
You know, we're still assessing all those available options to try to help those residents. From my understanding, we had about 15 staying in there on Monday night. I'm not sure exactly how many stayed last night. I haven't gotten those numbers yet. But, you know, we're going to work with all of our nonprofit agencies. North Brevard Charities is a great one that's definitely helped in times of need to make sure people are housed and we get people where they need to be.
That was Titusville Mayor Andrew Connor speaking during a press conference yesterday addressing the town's flooding. To speak with us now about the flooding scene in Lake County, we're joined by Central Florida Public Media environment reporter Molly Durig. Molly, thank you so much for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Molly, so you were there on Tuesday in the aftermath of this flooding. Can you just walk us through what you saw out there?
Yeah, absolutely. I think what really struck me the most was the condition of North Donnelly Street. This is a road that pretty much in some parts has totally collapsed right around the downtown Mount Dora area. It leads right up to a retirement community where there were also some washouts, parts of the road that were washed out. Fortunately, no one was injured. Nobody died. There was reportedly a close call with someone in a car crossing the street right before the collapse, but fortunately she was okay. But yeah, it's certainly a striking image. The road is closed down for the foreseeable future, and it's not the only road that's been closed down, but certainly from what I saw, it's totally collapsed. So that was very striking. There's also quite a lot of standing water in some parts, in some people's lawns, and some streets. Portions of other streets remain closed down a couple days after this storm.
You mentioned, one of the main arteries there and a few other roads. I mean, how is navigating in and around Mount Dora?
Yeah, so at one point, actually, on Britt Road, just outside of Mount Dora in Lake County, I had to kind of quickly slam on my brakes because I was approaching a thing of standing water. I mean, it was several inches deep, and I saw several other cars go on through. At least one car water was entering their vehicle. They were kind of like opening the door and trying to like drain it out like as they were driving. A couple cars stopped and turned around, but I was honestly kind of taken aback by how many cars kept driving right on through.
As far as the folks who were affected by these floods, what were you hearing from them?
It was really interesting. I spoke with a few folks who were kind of stopping by North Donnelly Street, trying to take a look at the damage. And one gentleman, Steve Brothers, a Mount Dora resident, said he got a couple of inches of water in his house.
The downpour is unbelievable. I'm saying, when is this going to stop? We're going to get flooded here. Well, sure enough, we did. At one point, it went in the room and there's water all over the floor. So we got to deal with it. We're not the only ones. I'm sure there's a lot of people worse off than we are.
Kind of the vibe I was picking up from people was they weren't surprised, right? They live in an area that gets flooded sometimes. There's sort of an attitude of like resignation to it, but also just hoping to get things fixed quickly. That's another big thing. Folks are hoping that these roads do not stay out of commission for very long because it's a small town. Obviously, Mount Dora's weekly arts festival, lots of local vendors, and the city in general has lots of local events, and people are a little concerned about the local business and how folks are going to be getting around the town.
So, Molly, as an Orange County resident, 19 inches, that's a crazy amount of water for me to fathom. However, earlier you had mentioned that when you talked to locals about this, this wasn't actually something that they found all that surprising, even with such a large amount of water coming on so quickly. So could you walk us through that mentality?
I think that it's an interesting thing, right? People are, trying to do their best just getting through. And so maybe there's that element too, people just trying to stay positive. But I talked to a gentleman, Andrew Duncan, who's not originally from the area, but has lived there for many years. And he talked about this isn't necessarily something that we expected to happen, but we are still in hurricane season until the end of November. While this was obviously not a hurricane, extreme rain events can happen. And I spoke with a man named Andrew Duncan who lives in the area and said, this isn't necessarily what he expected, but it's hurricane season. So kind of got to be prepared, got to stay safe. And he was grateful that the area wasn't hit harder.
It just was raining very loud. It was raining all the time, and it continued, and the police cars was blocked up all around here and stopping people from going that way. It's just something that we didn't expect to happen, but these things happen in this kind of hurricane season.
Do we have any idea as far as, like, damage totals, what officials are saying, the actual, like, monetary value of these damages are yet?
That's a great question. As of Tuesday afternoon, the city and Lake County both said that they don't have those totals yet. They are working to come up with a better sense of the damage. Also, we'll just throw out there that the state is pitching in to help. Governor Ron DeSantis said Tuesday that the Division of Emergency Management is going to help pump water to the tune of 30 million gallons from Lake County, from the flooded area. So that just gives you a sense of how much flood water there is still, again, a couple days after. And also the Florida Department of Transportation will be helping with it. He said at least 4 roadways in Lake County. So hopefully the state will be able to help. That's something I heard expressed by some of the residents, too, that they're hoping the state can come in and help and get things cleaned up more quickly.
We're talking about the human element of this, obviously. But I'm wondering, since you are our environment reporter, if you noticed any wildlife that had actually been displaced as a domino effect of all of this. Obviously, humans are not the only ones affected by these flash flood events. Did you notice anything like that?
Yeah, it's funny you say that. I actually did notice what looked like a turtle that you'd find in the water. It looked like a snapping turtle to me. It was right on the side of the road. He was alive. Looked like he might have been...
Alive, great. Glad to hear that.
Yeah, alive, great. But no,
not
I was
where
also,
he should be.
I was also like, oh no, I didn't want to see him in that situation. But anyways, a local business owner had a shovel and kind of like navigated him off the road as gently as possible. So hopefully they'll be all right. But that definitely does happen with events like these. Wildlife getting displaced and land getting displaced, obviously, as well, and eroding. So
it sounds like, you know, some locals are taking it upon themselves to provide some relief for animals that were affected by this. As far as relief for the residents of the area, has there been any sort of relief set up yet?
Yes, that's a great question. So Mount Dora is making sandbags available to folks who may need them. And they have said that you can pick those up at the Frank Brown Sports Complex at 1245 Pine Avenue. You need to bring your own shovel. Mount Dora is encouraging residents who need help with disaster recovery, including anyone affected by flooding. They're encouraging folks to contact Lake Support and Emergency Recovery, also known as LASER. Also, there was a precautionary boil water notice in effect. The city is waiting on the results of water sampling, so it doesn't mean that the water is contaminated. What it means is they don't know if it's contaminated. Mm. So they're waiting to see. And in the meantime, there has been a boil water notice in effect. So basically, stay posted, keep an eye on the social media channels and the websites of your local governments, of the city of Mount Dora, Lake County.
As far as water totals go, was there an estimate that was released on that?
Yeah, so some parts of Lake County, I believe Eustis got hit the hardest with more than 19 inches over a 24-hour period. Mount Dora took on nearly 18 inches. So yeah, in that range. And just to kind of put some context on that, I looked up the National Weather Service has a really handy tool called Now Data that lets you compare climate trends over time. And looking at the years between 1991 and 2020, so the totals for at the Leesburg Municipal Airport, the annual total is just under 44 inches. So wow. If you think about that, 19 inches, that's like 43% of a whole year in 24 hours. The October normal for Leesburg Municipal Airport is just under 3 inches. So again, 19 inches in 24 hours. That might help you put it into context. This was a very irregular event.
Molly Durig, environment reporter with Central Florida Public Media. Molly, thank you so much again for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me, Joe Mario.
Joining us now is Megan Borowski, a meteorologist with the Florida Public Radio Emergency Network. Megan, thank you so much for joining us.
Absolutely. It's a pleasure to be here.
Megan, Floridians were pretty shocked by how much rain there was at the tail end of last weekend. Central Florida Public Media even spoke to the mayor of Titusville. We just heard from him expressing his shock over the event that came through on Sunday and Monday. Can you describe for us, you know, what was this weather event? And, you know, why is it that it kind of felt like it came out of nowhere?
Yeah, I mean, it's a very good question, right? Because we didn't have like a big hurricane that was moving into our area. We didn't really even have a big weather system that was moving into our area either. What happened was we had a stall front nearby. We had winds coming off the Atlantic Ocean, and it kind of just set the stage to feed a great deal of moisture into Central Florida and kind of just feed heavy rain rates from thunderstorms during Sunday evening. And that really just set the stage for an unprecedented rainfall event, which, you know, goes to show, again, we talk about this all the time, even leading up to hurricane season, that we don't necessarily even need to have a system move through to really trigger heavy rainfall. Now, of course, this is quite isolated, but, you know, it's all we need is just a little bit of a front, good tropical moisture nearby, and wham, bam, boom, we can get these heavy thunderstorms and exceptional amounts of rainfall.
You know, as far as that storm is considered, Sunday into Monday, and then, you know, we had additional rain come Tuesday, but especially in that Sunday to Monday, it just kind of hung over. Do we know what caused the system to kind of stall and hang over the counties like that for an entire day?
Well, there was weak steering in the atmosphere. So, you know, if you have stiff winds in the, you know, the lower, the mid-levels, you can get these storms moving on through quickly. But if you have kind of lighter winds, you can have these storms bubble up and then just sit overhead. And then, you know, unfortunately, when you have that tropical moisture overhead, that just feeds the thunderstorm to, you know, create heavy rainfall over that one area. So the culprit for that, yeah, was weak steering winds. Those storms just didn't have anything pushing them out of that one particular part of Lake County.
As far as this kind of storm goes, I know that we're in, you know, the tropical season, though. You expect to see this kind of phenomenon from a tropical storm event. But when it comes to these, you know, these flooding events, I'm a little surprised that we'd see something like this outside of, like, you know, severe storm season. So my question is, you know, is a weather phenomenon of this nature, is this unusual for this time of the year?
Well, I would say, you know, we're trending toward the dry season. Yes, we're still in tropical season, the hurricane season. This event obviously was very unusual. I would say, you know, in October into November, we can see pockets of heavier rainfall. But certainly this particular event with the over a foot of rain, yes, very, very unusual, especially now as we're turning again out of your typical sea breeze thunderstorm season into dry season. We've seen in the past during sea breeze season those heavier cells developing and parking overhead and creating flash flood conditions. That's when I'd say an extreme event like this would be more likely to happen, especially if steering winds are weak. But this point in time, this is definitely an outlier and something that hopefully we don't see again anytime soon.
I believe I am, and so are all of our listeners are right there with you on that. I want to ask you a question here, something that you brought up earlier about perhaps something that informed this flooding. You mentioned, tropical fuel for this particular, not to mix metaphors here, but for this particular fire. Did we see this extreme weather as a result of Hurricane Melissa? Did it impact this weather in any sort of way?
I don't know if I would say as a result of. I would certainly say that we had, you know, we're kind of in the subtropics, borderline of the tropics as we get farther down into the Florida Peninsula. And so the ingredients that were kind of in the general vicinity to fuel Melissa were also nudging into our area. So I don't know if I would say causation, but I would say there's a correlation of, yeah, there was tropical moisture nudging into our area, and it was that same tropical moisture in general that was helping to feed Melissa, especially once the shear down in the Caribbean petered out.
So not a direct impact, but a little bit of a connection there.
A little bit, yeah. But again, not, you know, this was not from Hurricane Melissa, I'll say that.
Megan, can I ask you to stay with us on break? We want to talk to you more about Hurricane Melissa.
Absolutely.
Great. When we return, we'll speak with Megan Borowski about the impact of Hurricane Melissa. I'm Joe Mario Pedersen, filling in for Sharon Stone here on Central Florida Public Media. This is Engage.
There's a lot going on in space, from efforts to land astronauts on the moon
and liftoff of Artemis 1
to answering the age-old question, are we alone in the universe?
Wouldn't you want to know if there was life on another planet?
Are We There Yet? Explores space exploration every Tuesday at 6:30 here on Central Florida Public Media.
You're listening to Engage on Central Florida Public Media. I'm Joe Mario Pedersen, sitting in for Sharon Stone. Ahead on the program, Orlando partying is moving out of the clubs and into the coffee houses, and the party begins much earlier. We'll talk about how millennials are shifting from nightlife to daylife. But first, Hurricane Melissa barreled through the Caribbean this week, rapidly gaining Category 5 strength before hitting Jamaica with 185-mile-per-hour maximum sustained winds and torrential rainfall from the south on Tuesday. We continue with Megan Borowski with the Florida Public Radio Emergency Network. Megan, last I had checked, Melissa is still very much, you know, it has its hurricane status as of, you know, us talking about it as Category 2. Hurricane Melissa was a Category 5 storm, and the storm was interesting for a number of reasons. I was wondering if you could walk us through why Melissa stood out so much to meteorologists.
Oh, yeah. I mean, we could sit and talk about this for a while. First things first is we had shear in the basin, and so that prevented Melissa from becoming a hurricane right out of the starting gate. But once the wind shear died out south of Jamaica and south of Haiti, we saw explosive growth with Melissa over last weekend. And so that was one of the things just to marvel at, not in a good way, but in a, oh my gosh, sort of way, watching this storm rapidly intensify as it's just moving so slowly over the waters, and watching it, become one of the strongest hurricanes ever in the Atlantic Basin right before it made landfall. We'll be talking about the records here for a while. You know, it was the strongest hurricane on record, I believe, to make landfall in Jamaica. It has one of the lowest pressures in the Atlantic Basin. I believe at landfall, the pressure was 892 millibars, which is low, very, very low. It's not the lowest ever in the entirety of the world, but that is quite low. And then just, again, correlated with the pressure, the winds, extreme category 5 winds at 185 mile an hour winds at landfall. So that explosive growth right before landfall, and also the lack of anything that was steering Melissa while it was impacting the islands. You really see the effects of a major hurricane amplified when you have that long duration of impacts over one area. So we'll be talking about all these things and looking at all these things for years going forward.
You know, Megan, you mentioned that Melissa had this incredible strength, the jaw-dropping strength. But we're on the other side of the peak of hurricane season. So my question here is it unusual to see a major storm of this caliber, a Category 5 no less, in late October?
Well, I wouldn't say it's too unusual. If you remember back to even last year, Milton was maybe just 1 or 2 weeks ahead of what we're experiencing now. So the same M storm, so to speak. So we're at the same point in the alphabet. So not totally out of norm for this time of year. Again, Milton had that explosive growth well before it made landfall, thankfully, when it was over the Gulf. So, not out of the realm of norm as well. I also think back to, just because it impacted, me personally, was Superstorm Sandy. It wasn't, that was more of a hybrid storm. Again, it wasn't too strong, but it had major impacts, and that was toward Halloween time back in, 2012, I think. It's a while back, but, no, not totally out of the realm of normal to have this strong of a storm this late in the season, especially since we've had nothing so far that was too intense over the Caribbean.
This hurricane season is, close to the end here. I was wondering if, you might be able to characterize the 2025 season compared to, say the last 5 years or, seasons in general. How would you describe it?
Well, I would say We're still moving along through the season. We still have a month left, and a lot can happen over the course of 4 weeks. I will say that it's been quite the unusual season in the fact that we've seen bursts of activity and then we've had weeks worth of a lull where, even as we got toward the peak of season, August into September, there really was not a whole lot going on. But then we'll see bursts of activity again. And so kind of tracking those bursts and then lulls will be quite interesting once we get in the off season and look back at the data. The other thing, too, is the fact that the strong hurricanes, or the hurricanes that we did have, they were strong. We had, I believe it was Aaron earlier in the year. We have Melissa now. So, looking at how those quickly intensified, rapid intensification has been the buzzword for the, past several seasons. And that's going to continue to be the buzzword, just for example, what we saw with Melissa. So that's another thing. And then, the last one that I would say is the fact that we have lucked out in the contiguous United States. And I don't want to, we still have a month left, so I don't want to totally say we're in the clear.
We're all knocking on wood right
yeah,
now.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, we're still, I have conversations all the time of we are all still reeling from last season, where I think as a total, we had 3 landfalls over the state of Florida. And it was, between Helene and Milton, it was only a matter of a few weeks. And so, this season, I will be quite thankful if we can breathe a sigh of relief on November 30th without any direct impacts. But yeah, in the United States, I believe the only impact we had was from Chantel. And that was a tropical storm. I'm not 100% on this, but I believe that was early July. It was just a little bit after Independence Day, and that impacted the Carolinas. So, you know, remarkable so far in a good way that, you know, all of the storms, or most of them rather, have kind of developed over the Atlantic and recurved thanks to steering patterns. And now as we get later into the autumn, the jet will dip farther south. That means we should have more cold fronts, so to speak, or troughs of low pressure reaching down into the mid-Atlantic and into the southern states. And hopefully that will help to serve as a shield against anything if it does develop. We just had a front move through Florida last night. It's still moving through the length of the state, bringing in colder and drier air, which is kind of nice for Halloween. But at the same time, that is helping to guide Melissa over the Atlantic, keeping it away from the United States. So hopefully that pattern of those fronts moving on through, now that we're well into autumn, can continue and just keep anything tropical away.
I'm right there with you. I'm sure everyone listening is as well. You know, we have a little more than 30 days left of the season. So we appreciate that outlook that you're giving us as far as the tropics are concerned. We've been speaking with Megan Borowski, a meteorologist with the Florida Public Radio Emergency Network. Megan, thank you so much for joining us today.
Anytime.
Approximately 65,000 Jamaicans call Central Florida home. Many have been concerned for friends and family who still live on the island. Debbie Jolly Jarrett plays many roles with Jamaican Cultural Connection, an Orlando-based nonprofit promoting the culture and support of Jamaicans, both here and on the island. Jolly Jarrett spoke with us this morning about what she's heard from family and friends in her hometown.
I am from Montego Bay, a happy little girl that grew up in Montego Bay. And to hear that Montego Bay is so devastated is heart-wrenching to a lot of us, of course, but also, of course, the entire island. And my sister lives in Kingston, and not being able to hear from her because of power cuts, it was, you know, you try to keep positive, oh, it's power cuts, but hearing from her this morning really made us happy. We have other members in St. Elizabeth, which was hit very hard, Black River, that's St. Elizabeth, and we're just praying that they're okay, because the shelters were blown away. The hospitals were blown away. So we're very worried. We haven't heard from them. A lot of the telecommunication towers are down. They're trying their best, you know, to expedite rebuilding that. I'm glad my sister was able to even text us. So I am worried. I'm a daughter of Jamaica, along with many other daughters and sons, aunts, uncles, brothers, sisters, and we're very close, especially Montego Bay.
Debbie, in regard to that history, I do want to talk to you because of like how scary this storm was. I recall you saying that you went, you know, some time without talking to your sister, but you guys were able to connect. How long did you go without talking to her?
Before it hit, we couldn't get through to her. And we were worried. We're very close. And I don't think words can explain how scared we were that we lost our sister. And did she evacuate? Where is she? Is she with friends? We didn't know. But we just heard from her. And then she's in Kingston, but we still have a lot of family and friends in Montego Bay, but they had shelters we knew they were going to, and I was able to speak with them throughout the night of the hurricane. Power was still up, and I encouraged one aunt of mine. I said, please go to the shelter. She didn't want to leave, which is a big issue with hurricanes. People don't want to evacuate, and it's so imperative that they do. But she eventually went. I asked two friends of mine to go get her and take her to the shelter, just down the road to the schools. Schools and churches were shelters. We had 800 shelters, and only 300 were occupied out of the 800, to show you that they don't want to go.
Debbie, you know, you mentioned that you were a daughter of Montego Bay, and you know, there's been a lot of destruction there. As far as, you know, the Montego Bay that you remember, how much of that is still standing right now?
Not one bit of it, my dear.
I'm really sorry to hear that.
Not one bit. The videos I've seen, churches are down, schools are down, the beaches are mashed up completely. And, you know, Montego Bay is the main tourist portal. And so to see that, that's devastating.
As far as what it takes to start rebuilding, what sort of efforts are we seeing here to help that initiative?
Okay. For instance, Jamaican Cultural Connection, Inc., we have already started to troubleshoot. We want to go back to doing the monetary donations. And monetary donations, yes, to get food to the people, but also to get building materials and so on, whatever it takes to rebuild. Gravel to rebuild the streets, because a lot of the roads are down. There were a lot of mudslides. We need to fix the drainage systems. So what we're doing on the 22nd, we're having a prayer breakfast and asking people to donate monetary funds. But if they also want to bring clothes and things like that, that's fine as well. But that's not our priority right now. Our priority is feeding the people, getting them what they need, you know? That's going to be at Apopka Methodist Church.
Debbie, you know, as far as, you know, that destruction that you mentioned with the roads, I imagine that there is a want to get that down there and, you know, hug your sister, hug your family. I imagine it's probably difficult to get down there at this moment. Are there any plans to, or is right now a wait and see kind of moment?
It's wait and see because we have two airports, Norman Manley in Kingston and Sangster Airport in Montego Bay. Sangster Airport in Montego Bay is totally gone. It's smashed. There's no airport. So they're working diligently to do what they can to build back that airport. However, Norman Manley in Kingston, they were able to make it so that for emergency landing only. That's what's happening. So people are trying to, a tourist, I must say, God bless the tourists. They're like, you know what? We're here and we'll help take things up off the street debris. They're helping. Somehow reporting live from down there. I mean, everybody's has hands on deck. And I, in a way, devastation brings togetherness.
You know, it's not the circumstances that you want, but as far as the response goes, that's the best you can hope for. And I'm glad to hear that.
Yes, and I pray that it doesn't just take a disaster to bring us together as one world and as Bob Marley sang, One Love. Yes, but that's what's going on now. A lot of togetherness, no color, no creed, no nothing, just everybody loving each other and helping each other, helping their fellow man. And that's beautiful.
Debbie Jolly Jarrett is with Jamaican Cultural Connection. We'll have links on our website. Coming up, daytime parties, coffee, and house music events are picking up steam in Central Florida. I went to one to see why it's getting so popular. You're listening to Engage.
The Wrap is a podcast from Central Florida Public Media, curating the top Central Florida news stories and in-depth reporting each week. Join me, Brendan Byrne, as I bring you news headlines, deep reporting dives, and insightful conversations from the news team. A new episode of The Wrap every Friday morning. Get it wherever you get your podcasts.
You are listening to Engage on Central Florida Public Media. I'm Joe Mario Pedersen, filling in for Sharon Stone. Coffee parties, daytime drinking, and daylight dancing. Getting lit while it's still light out. I'm talking about partying during the day. This came up in our newsroom meetings, a rising trend in daytime dance parties in coffee shops and other eateries. I'm a night owl myself. In fact, I live for late nights. I love that energy. But this is a party for early birds, or those looking to head back to the nest at an appropriate time. It piqued my interest. Also, go to a party on company time? I'm sold. So I checked it out.
Let me see you roar.
I'm at the Orlando City Food Hall near Lake Ivanhoe Park for a Daylight Orlando Halloween party. Daylight Orlando puts on daytime parties and events. Now, coming here, I was expecting a small gathering inside the hall, older millennials who might burn bright and fade fast. Instead, Daylight Orlando was like a mini house music festival, complete with vendors selling shirts, essential oils, and art. Inside the hall is two stories with dance floors on each. All around me are people in costume for the Halloween theme, including one guy who I just kept bumping into. He was dressed as Mermaid Man from Nickelodeon's SpongeBob SquarePants show, who's kind of like a geriatric parody on Adam West's comedic Batman. The guy's name is Josue Palenco. He's 27 and has lived and partied in Orlando for about 10 years, usually at night though. This was his third Daylight Orlando event.
Sometimes when I'm off on the weekends, I'll either come here and go to work. I'm not really partying too hard where I could still have fun and go to work, but it's a cool way to enjoy myself, like I said, during the day. If it wasn't for that, I'd probably be working hours, staying at home if it wasn't for a daytime party, so it's definitely a good way to go out and have fun.
When you do daytime partying, are you going to drink coffee? Are you drinking alcohol? Like, or are you just dancing? You kind of seem like you already have like so much energy.
Yeah, I would say my friends describe me as like positive, high energy. I don't even have to have any drinks, honestly, to have a good time. I'm just like there for the vibes. Yeah, exactly. Like there for the vibes, good coffee here and there. I love a matcha latte, or like had an espresso martini, which was fun. But other than that, I'm not really just here to drink. I'm just here to enjoy the vibes. So that's why I like it. I still have the rest of my day to enjoy myself while still partying and have fun with my friends.
That was the goal of the two DJs who co-founded Daylight Orlando, Vladimir Crane, aka DJ Chino, and Rupesh Patel. Here's DJ Chino.
Well, you know, we've been DJing since we were 15 years old, and we can't tell you how old we are, but we've been DJing for a very, very long time, and now that we're getting older, a lot of our friends and clients are now not going out late. So eventually we came up with a concept of doing it during the daytime and getting everybody, including their families, to come out and enjoy the party.
Earlier this year, Chino and Rupesh were both DJing in Miami during Music Week. They played the clubs and also attended a few pool parties. They were impressed when they saw lines forming at 7 a.m. That was something they wanted to bring to Orlando, where partying and house music options are, well, to be polite, limited. They unofficially started their concept by hosting coffee parties at cafes around town.
Actually was a hit. Everybody loves coffee. Everybody loves caffeine in the morning. And we were getting up to 800-900 people coming out at 7:30 a.m. And so we were like, okay, well, you know, they love coffee. Let's bring them up to different locations. And that's how it came to be.
They officially started Daylight in March. In May, they had a Daylight Orlando event at the Great Southern Box Company, another food hall in Orlando. Here's DJ Rupesh.
We have some people that want to party all day, all night long. There's people that come after, so we do a coffee party at 7 o'clock in the morning, and there's people that come straight from the club or the after party to our party. So there's some of those people. I think the majority of our people are pretty much just, they have responsibilities the next day. They have a family, they have a job, and they just want to party till 5 o'clock and be home by dinner time.
Their mini house music festival format of bringing daytime partying around town took off fast, with plans for other locations around the state, the country, and across the world.
We have multiple cities now. We're doing a party in Tampa, so we have Daylight Tampa, Daylight New Jersey, Daylight New York, Daylight Atlanta. We've already done Daylight Greece. Daylight Mumbai, India's coming up with our good friends. So, you know, like I said, we've been DJing all over the world. We've been everywhere.
We also have Sydney coming up, Australia.
Puerto Rico.
Puerto Rico coming up, and the Philippines, so Manila. We have so many DJ friends all over the world that are, you know, they want to be part of the movement. They want to do the parties, and so we're going to team up with them and help them create their following in their city as well.
So that's amazing, first of all. Second, so what it kind of sounds like is, like, for the coffee party, like, craze that was going on, it sounds like a wave was building, and you guys managed to, like, catch this wave with Daylight, and this wave is now going many other places. Am I correct in saying that?
We actually have two coffee parties the same day. One, November 15th in New Jersey, Somerville, New Jersey, at Bliss Cafe, and then in Tampa at Blind Tiger Coffee on the same day. So, fortunately, you know, we have amazing friends that are going to be helping us put this on and amazing DJs that they're curating. So we're just excited about this brand and excited to see the potential of, you know, and the growth.
I gotta ask about the vibe of like daytime partying versus like nighttime partying. Is the vibe like relatively the same? Do you see people go like hard as hell like during the day or like?
You're a lot more energetic during the day. You know, you get your caffeine kick. They don't need alcohol. They need caffeine. They just go through it. And honestly, like the energy, the vibe, people are happier during the day. I mean, late night is way different. They're depending on alcohol to get going, where you wake up in the morning, you're excited for the day, you're ready to challenge the day, have fun. And I think the energy during the daytime party is definitely a lot stronger.
Yeah, I definitely agree. You know, people are, you know, at our coffee party, there's not that much alcohol there. Getting drunk and, you know, people are vibing out like it's a club, and we love it.
Caffeine.
And our DJs love it too. They get so much energy out of that, you know?
The daytime party truly was a family affair, with people of all ages in attendance, from young kids to folks in their 40s and 50s. Among the costumed Nickelodeon characters and members of the Mario and Luigi gang, a woman stood out to me, Angela Bennies. She was wearing a shirt with the phrase, Teen Day Drunk. The 45-year-old Claremont resident was at the party with her friends in matching shirts. They were at a breast cancer awareness walk not far away and wanted something fun to do after the walk.
You know what? We're going to kill two birds with one stone today. You know, we're going to do, obviously, support, you know, the cause for breast cancer, and then, you know, come and enjoy our day and just, you know, again, bless for another breath. That's all I can say, you know, but definitely knew about it. We searched it, you guys. You know, we follow these parties all the time for the daylight and, you know, this is exactly the vibe. Some people have their kids here playing, you know, shopping, you know, there's folks dancing.
This is Angela's second Daylight Orlando experience. Angela likes going out late to party, but daytime partying, she likes the options it gives her.
Sometimes day drinking does lead into night drinking, although I still love to get home, hang out with my puppies, and go to bed early so I can be afresh the next day.
That's all for today's edition of Engage. Join us next Thursday when we look at how cuts in HIV testing and treatment are impacting Central Floridians. I'm Joe Mario Pedersen, sitting in for Sharon Stone. Thank you for joining us. All Things Considered is coming up following NPR News.